get stopped at 10 in suburban highs. Let's start the show with Lewis Tennant. Here we go. Guests and interviews that you're looking for, with creators, innovators, and so much more. For all episodes and further info, verbalhighs.com is the place to go.
All right, woohoo! Welcome to the first ever Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs podcast. I'm going to keep this little introduction as little as possible. Maybe they'll extend as the weeks go on as I release podcasts, but really I just want to launch into what will be the first of a number of weekly interviews and guests. So I've recorded three thus far, just to get a little buffer. First one will get released today. I'll tell you who the guest is very shortly. And then from then on, each Tuesday, a show will get released. I'm thinking I will break the seven-day rule this time, and depending on feedback from this one, I'll probably release the second one next Tuesday. So exciting, if not for all the thousands of you, for me and the eight people who I definitely know will tune in. So I'm Lewis Tennant. The podcast is called Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs. It's the result of me listening to long-form interview podcasts hopelessly and ridiculously and probably addicted style for the last at least couple of years. I've chopped hundreds and hundreds of hours of Marc Maron. I was late to the play with WTF, the famous podcast, which if you don't know about, culminated probably a year ago with President Barack Obama ending up in his garage in L.A. Who can I hope for here? Winston Peters? the likes of Joe Rogan, who would think that I'd listen to a mixed martial artist smoke weed and talk with his comedian friends for 3 or so hours. That sounds like a little prejudice on my part about the MMA thing. Not at all. I'm just not really an MMA guy. I'm not really a sport guy, but now I suddenly know a lot about MMA, but all the kind of other hundreds of things they end up chatting about. Also, Nerdist and those kind of shows. So people were saying, listen to your hardcore histories, listen to all your kind of well-recorded, well-produced, well-researched, you know, weeks in production-style podcasts. And some of those are incredible, and I get it, and I get the journalistic side. And I do listen to Criminal and things like that, but I found that I really just like the idea of getting the interesting New Zealanders and hopefully global people I know into the place I'm standing now, which is at my kitchen bench in Kingsland, and talking about why and how and where they do the things that they do. So from actors to comedians to musicians to chefs. Anyone know a chef that is a bit of a raconteur? Send them my way. So welcome. As I say, get on with it. Get to the interview. Please stay. Quick thank yous. Thanks to friends who helped out with different skill levels. Well, thanks to all friends who just said, yeah, you'd be great at that. You should get it going. And I have, and I've decided to do it properly. And there's a website and so on, which we'll get to, an actual website that takes you just to this and to being able to contact me. But thanks to Paul at paulwalsh.co.nz. If you go to my site, verbalhighs.com, he's done that amazing hand-drawn logo. He also took what was about a 90% finished website on my part and shined the proverbial turd. Although it was a lovely, tapered, healthy, fiber-rich turd, Paul really took it to award-winning turd territory. So I don't know if that's a great way of promoting him and his work in my website, but there you go. If you'd like a fantastic polished turd, perhaps visit Paul at paulwalsh.co.nz. He also sells amazing art, and he does those chorus boxes around Auckland for those of you in Auckland City. Paints them and makes them look nice. Paul, if you're not looking for extra work, I'm very sorry. Your website might crash now. Maybe you should hide under the couch. Thanks to my uncle Graham over in Australia, who owns an audio business and also owns a whole lot of knowledge after decades of audio production and setting up gear and stuff and thingies and so on. And I said, look, I need a couple of decent mics for the podcast, but more importantly, he provided a solution. People are about providing solutions. So in other words, buy these for cheap. And then they arrived a couple of days later in the mail, and they sound great. I've recorded three interviews so far, and I'm ranting to you on one of the mics now. Thanks to my dear friend Leon, Mr. Dahl, who came over and taught me, actually he didn't teach me, I sat there and said, please make it happen. He made a very lovely compressor setting, which for those of you who don't know about audio, means that when you listen to podcasts and you have to turn them up and down and the mic works terrible and it's a nightmare, that's not only often shitty mics, it actually can be good mics with terrible compression. So hopefully myself and my guests will all be squished together lovely in your ears, whether or not you're listening on speakers or on headphones. Last shout is to a guy I've never met. His name is Custom Drum Loops. His parents were hippies. No, just kidding. I don't think that's his real name. But he's at that website Fiverr where you do stuff for US $5. And he more than excelled for US $5. In fact, I felt a little emotional when I listened to that intro you just heard, the ukulele jam, the 90s sitcom-esque piece of kitsch loveliness. So if you want something similar or some of other his other services, rather, go to custom, search out Custom Drum Loops, one word, at Fiverr. Okay, lovely day in Auckland today. Worry about global warming. Worry about the impending end of the world. I worry about the oceans emptying out. I worry about everywhere being too hot. I worry about everyone leaving other parts of the world and coming to New Zealand. I worry about the world ending. But today, my tomato plant it looks amazing. And a lot of the people on the street look very amazing too. Very summery. Lovely to see out there. Neighbour just wandered past with a box of beers. He's a grafter. He's been working all day up before I got up. He's looking at me, talk to myself. I don't think he can see the mic. I'll let him think what he thinks. Okay, lastly, before I introduce the guest, different ways to contact me. There's been a lot of work behind the scenes. I'm quite happy. I hope it all works. But can you please support and like and make some presents and comment and so on all the different platforms I've set up? That would be lovely. Can you please spread the word? Of course, spread the shows. The ways to do that is verbalhighs.com. Custom one word, verbalhighs.com, short for Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs, the podcast. Myself, Lewis Tennant. You can email me, verbalhighs1word@gmail.com, or through the website, there's contact boxes and so on that actually end up in that box. So go there. You want to be, you know, if you want to be a guest, you know, someone who wants to be a guest, you want to throw some money this way, some product. That's a bit garish, but I wouldn't mind being supported by someone. If you think, you know, this kind of fits your audience and so on, and you got a product or service, yes, I have thought about that. Early days yet, though. Twitter, my handle is verbalhighs, all one word. Please like. Please get amongst, please share from there if that's your platform. On Facebook, Verbal Highs Podcast, one word. Yes, there is some, what looks like a band with 28 supporters who have taken Verbal Highs. So Verbal Highs Podcast at Facebook, but if you just type DR, space, tenants, etc., I'll be the first thing that comes up. So support me there. Those of you who know me, no, I've got quite a presence on Facebook, on my private page. I'm more Facebook savvy than Twitter, but however you can support me, please support me. Share, comment, etc. Comments boxes are open on the website. I don't want it to end up like the spin-off, where it seems like perfectly reasonable and intelligent kind of website or service had to turn their comments section off because of the worst of people that exist on the internet. So, you know, digital hugs. Support each other. Make critical analysis and comment, but don't be bastards. What else? iTunes. Have an iTunes subscription coming. Pop fact, everyone. I learned this throughout doing this. I can't just go straight into providing an iTunes feed that you can subscribe to, because a human being has what sounds to me like quite a fantastic and fun job of listening to the first of each new podcast at the iTunes castle, wherever Apple lives up on that hill, surrounded by, I was going to say bats, but someone from iTunes is going to listen to this from Apple, surrounded by unicorns grazing. They listen to make sure that it doesn't incite hate speech, which we don't do, we incite love speech, that it doesn't contain too much swearies, that you've ticked the swearies box if you do swearies. So once that person, hello person, listens to the first podcast and touch wood okays it, I'll get that iTunes subscription happening. One thing you could contact me about early on is, do people still use RSS feeds? I've had two different opinions on that. Someone said, yes, I do all the time. A couple of other people said, no, they're very old school way of doing stuff. Is it enough just for me to say, hey, the next show's up via all these platforms? So if you want to give me a little comment or an email or whatever, would you use an RSS feed? Anyway, that stuff aside, ladies and gentlemen, I can't even remember if I've said who the first guest is. I'm not going to tell you who the other two are. They're already recorded. They'll come out later. Is Mr. Thomas Watts. He is guitarist and sexy dancer for New Zealand Alt-Rock, New Zealand Music Award-winning Alt-Rock band Villainy. I saw that happen last week. the New Zealand Music Award. I thought, whew, the ratings are going to go through the roof. He's also a colleague of mine in the communications department at AUT. We both teach students, hopefully quite well, how to create stories using audio. They make a little documentary for us. He does other courses as well. So storyteller and audio engineer extraordinaire. He's also worked on 7 Days for many years, the comedy panel show on Friday nights that continues to rate well. And just recently, as he reveals in the podcast, he's been filling and producing that, which is quite, you know, it's quite up there. But it's not a surprise when you know Thomas, because that's a testament to the fact that he's a lovely man, a hard worker, has a great sense of humour. Sound like I'm filling in a dating profile for him. And he's one of the first people I thought of getting in, because I knew that not only would he, not only is he doing so many fantastic things, but that he'd come with a bit of sort of a cheeky, acerbic nature, a dryness, an intelligence, and so on and so on and so on. And he certainly did. And we talked about, as I envisaged on the show, not just, hey, I tune my guitar that way and blah, 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 but kind of more about life and sort of philosophized about a few different things and so on. So the proof's in the pudding. Ladies and gentlemen, the first episode of Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs with Mr. Thomas Watts.
This is Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs.
Well, you've got great mic technique there.
Well, good. I'm just kind of sitting in front of it and talking into it.
Years in the game. Welcome. This is actually, I guess, it's kind of, does this destroy the flow if I say this is the pilot? We're recording the pilot, because I might end up putting you on third or fourth. But the pilot, I mean, the pilot's, it's got experimental connotations, hasn't it?
Give yourself two options.
What's the second one?
Well, the one is you say, hey, this is the pilot, or, this is just another episode, which we've already had multiple ones of already, and you know the format of how this works. I don't need to tell you. I'm Lewis. Hi, welcome to Lewis's excitement machine, or whatever it's called.
Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs.
Is that what it's called?
Yeah.
That's great.
I thought it would have come up in your... Well, I mean, I should have maybe paid for Facebook Reach. I thought it would have come up in your feed.
No. I'm sorry. If Zuckerberg hasn't said it's okay, it's not okay.
I think you got to drop the... Actually, you're a... Oh, actually, I'll introduce you first. So, world, this is Mr. Thomas Watts, rock guitarist for the chart-topping New Zealand band Villainy.
That's true.
Broadcasting radio audio teacher.
Yep.
And something at the Download Concept that produces Seven Sharp.
Seven Sharp.
Oh, God.
Shit.
That produces. How is Hosking? That produces.
Lovely.
Seven
Very
Day.
Kind.
I'm sure that's been done before, actually.
Yes, it happens.
Days and Sharp. That does something. You do something at 7 Days that I'll get to the bottom of later on that I want to talk about. You're also a. I was thinking about this before. An academic in remission, but I think it sounds more mighty and powerful and potentially forward looking to where you end up in academia, that you're a dormant, currently a dormant academic.
I feel that way. I like the idea of doing more research, and there are things that I would research, but just the notion of going into 5 years of PhD sadness isn't particularly appealing to me right now.
Why 5 years?
Because it'll take me a long time.
I treated it like a private sector contract that had to be banged out in 3 years. But then I had the scholarship, so that was also that. It was like, I get it done while those things are going. So I was thinking about this today. You were like, I've got 90 minutes, and that was fantastic, because that's all we need. I haven't decided on an exact time yet, and I thought, man, Thomas. Must be busy, so what's the average week like with juggling, as I say, being in the band, having to rehearse, doing however many hours you do it, down low, doing the amount of teaching you do, are you just kind of running around all day?
Basically, yeah. I mean, last week was a can I say clusterfuck? Am I allowed to say fuck? How do you feel about this?
The internet is an incredible and wild and open beast.
Last week was a clusterfuck, because it was a combination of, it was the end of the teaching year, 7 Days in full swing, but we're also doing pre-production at the same time, and so yeah, it was literally going. Oh, we're also on tour at the same time as well as that. So we're basically Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday evenings from 4 till 10, we were doing pre-production. But during the day, it was teaching. But then as soon as I finished teaching, I basically go to the download concert. We were putting together a...
From 4 till 10?
No. So from 4 till 10 is band stuff.
Oh, right. Okay. So six hours a night band stuff.
Well, that's what it was last week.
Right. So with the tour.
No, and then the tour, we played Wellington on Saturday night.
Yep.
So I should have actually gone through this in order. So I tend to teach from roughly, I'll teach probably like on average like about 3 or 4 hours a day.
Yeah.
I'll say 3 hours a day and then go to the download concept and fill in the rest of my time there. And the download is really interesting because I've been there for 8 years and I was originally hired to write music trivia for them, for the now defunct radio, but also TV show Pop Goes the Weasel.
Right.
But literally, that's what my job was. We're like,
that's kind of a fun gig coming out of uni, man.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Oh, the thing is, was that wasn't straight off the back of uni. Like, that was, I basically graduated with a Bachelor of Communication Studies majoring in radio. Basically tried to kind of get various kind of entry-level jobs, which I knew that I could do, but had no ability to prove that to anyone. And
that sounds like the last 20 years or so for me.
Absolutely, but that's exactly it. Like that notion of being able to prove that you can do something is a really fascinating thing, and that's one of the reasons why I like teaching.
Yeah.
Is that notion of trying to actually get students to put down on paper the things that they have the potential to do. Is kind of fascinating. And so basically and this is also how I got into academia, was I literally aged 21, I got asked if I wanted to teach, but I'd have to do postgrad. And so I basically, at that situation, being quite a fragile person, kind of went, I will go where people want me.
What do you mean fragile? You were like worried about being up in front of people, or fragile because you couldn't find work?
Fragile because I couldn't find work, absolutely. Right. Like, I mean, I have basically had that drilled into me from a young age, just that you work. That's how you do things, and that's how you do quality things. And it's also like there is happiness attached to that as well. There's happiness in doing a good job. And I don't know if it's happiness, but there is a sense of completion. Like, you know, that notion of, you know, crossing things off a list.
Yeah.
I get a massive buzz off that.
Oh, I got lists.
Yeah.
I got lists.
How often do they get updated?
My lists?
Yeah.
Probably daily things are crossed out and put on. But right. from kind of the, like, I'm the sort of person who'll, like, if I've done a recipe, cooked a recipe 80 times, I'll still have to have the recipe book, like I'd be no good on MasterChef or whatever. So what you're going, how does that relate to that? But no, so what I'm getting at is even the minutiae of my life will go on the list. I mean, not things like remember to put underwear on or brush your teeth, but maybe a tier above that.
Right. So
when I'm having
a list day, I literally put breakfast on there. So it's like, yeah, breakfast. I've done breakfast. I've nailed that bit.
But will you not have breakfast if you don't?
I'll definitely postpone it, and I'll feel more stoked when I finish it. Same with having a shower. You're like, yeah, I had a shower. Shit, yeah. Cross that off. I'm nailing today.
So you already clocked through maybe 8 list items before 8:30.
Yeah, totally. I'm a champion. By 10 o'clock, I've basically slayed the day. Until you look down at your list and you realize that there are like 70 things on it when you actually get down to that
kind of... And you've still got 3 jobs to go to.
Basically, yeah.
So back to that, what were we talking about? You were asked into...
All right, so in terms of how I got into academia, it was literally... I basically got asked by the head of radio, Matt Mulgard, to come back and do postgrad.
Yeah.
And I liked Matt a lot, and the notion of teaching I've always found really interesting. Like, I enjoy the notion of teaching.
I really enjoy it. It's made me more humble.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
It also... was fascinating because I was in front of a classroom having had a one-day teaching workshop, age 21, teaching students that I had been to high school with. Which is...
The same year? Or a few years?
No, like, literally, man. People that I were in my class.
That's actually really full-on. That's quite young, man.
No, I know.
Yeah.
With a day.
Would they wind you up? Well, I find students are pretty good at uni level. Or would they try it on?
No, the thing is that, like... through making, like, material most of my life, I've learned the ability not to laugh at things.
Yeah.
And as soon as you can not laugh, it basically gives you control of a room of kind of testosterone or, you know, estrogen or basically hormonal, like, 18-year-olds, because they're basically, especially dudes, like, they'll often try and, like, one-up each other in the first class to try and, like, establish who's the class clown. And if you can basically not laugh at that person who wants more than anything for you to laugh at their jokes, you basically position yourself in a different way to them, which I think is sensible. Because,
but you do have the, obvious initial and the fact that you're standing up the front and kind of conducting the orchestra.
Also true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think even now, I don't want this to be a two-hour podcast about teaching. I find now that even, every now and again, and I've only been doing it a few years, that I will still be, occasionally randomly terrified before a class. And I think that is a good thing, because I think it shows that you're still approaching it like, it's a kind of a performance in a way. It's something that your brain's kind of on three levels when you're in there. It's quite draining.
Totally.
And so I think once that kind of sort of anticipation or whatever of the performance goes, that so you're 21, you've had one I didn't even get one day of training, so that's good.
You just got chucked in there. That's
great. Yeah. How did it go?
It was fine. It was fine. They didn't know. You know what I mean? They didn't know. And the thing is that, but it's the same across like playing music as well.
Yeah,
is
yeah.
that notion of, you're right, it's a performance aspect, and it's the same when you are teaching. But it's this. I had this kind of light bulb moment when I was like, probably 15 or 16, which was watching another band playing, and thinking, I like watching that band. I would like to be someone that people like to watch.
So you freely admit you're an exhibitionist. There's an exhibitionist streak in you.
Yeah, totally. I'm an anxiety-filled extrovert.
I had myself... someone just described, who was doing it, because they saw similar to themselves, described me as a introverted extrovert with a superiority complex and an inferiority complex.
Right.
So I think that sounds like a kind of performer.
Yeah. Absolutely.
By nature.
Absolutely.
That sounds like therapy.
That's
it sounds
a status
like,
clown, yes.
Yeah. That's a French-trained... That's a French-trained clown. So back to last week.
Yep.
You had band shit 6 mm-hmm. to 10. You had download at some stage. You had the teaching. So are you like a kind of a weird... people to think of, but are you kind of a Margaret Thatcher, Helen Clark character who needs like 4 hours
sleep
a night?
No. Because the thing is, I was like, I'm absolutely the opposite. I need, as soon as I go under 8, it's basically like a gradual decline into madness and also sadness. And so I didn't realize that Monday was just a public holiday. I didn't realize.
Wow.
And so I basically had this moment with my my partner, who'd basically been really good the entire week, of A, not seeing me, but also like making breakfast and making sure that there was food and making sure that our guinea pigs were fed and those kind of things. And so I basically had this, oh my God, there's a day to recover. Having a day to recover, like, that you weren't planning on.
If your wife hadn't have been around, would you have turned up to teach on the public holiday at AUT?
I would have given it a go.
Okay.
I would just probably gather some people into a classroom. Like, I want to teach you about the importance of storytelling.
The two Chinese business students in the open bit of the building.
That starts smelling towards the end of semester.
Career in radio by a lost and tired Thomas.
Yeah, give it a go.
So the band thing, another thing I thought about today, so as I say, you're a busy guy. So to get to the bottom of that, so you just fit it all in when those kind of full-on moments come. But then even in the down times, you must be like a 60-hour-a-week guy.
Yeah, roughly. Like, say, for example...
I feel so slack, man. I mean, I like to think I'm thinking about work a lot, but that's full-on.
Mm. And whereas it was kind of, for me, I'm almost the opposite. Whereas I'm, like, in the sense that I, a lot of the time... am one of those, I'm probably actually going to become one of those really punishing people who shows up to something not having prepped enough and kind of wings things. And I hate those guys, but I've got this kind of feeling that I may accidentally become one.
Do you mean like, well, I mean, this is kind of podcasting really, but do you mean like showing up what, for the gig, for the band, for the teaching, for the download?
It would be mostly teaching, having not done enough prep, like, and kind of standing in front of the class going, what do you guys think about Nietzsche?
I'll give you 50 minutes to break away and talk about that, yeah, while I look, you at guys, my Facebook, you, and hurriedly Google some of the topic.
Tell me about Nietzsche.
To the band. So I was thinking, yeah, today I was thinking with all of these things, like, because you're, you know, I don't know whether this is just a career. I think a lot's attached to, you know, the what a creative is, or the way creative people are, or creative people do this and do that and so on. But I remember once I did this test online with my girlfriend at the time about how much, what was it? What was it called? It was like how much of your, I'm trying to think of the term, like your identity. How much of your identity is attached to your work? It was an interesting test in that, you know, if you just kind of got like a job, like the Chris Rock bit about a job versus a career where you look at the clock, probably not a lot of identity attached to it. But obviously if you, because you, going back to when you said, you know, you knew you could do all this stuff and you couldn't do it, no doubt a lot of them were kind of creative-y roles. So I thought about all the stuff you're doing and the three roles you're doing. Like I see the teaching as creative, and we're in a creative field that we're teaching. But so what's at the top of your kind of identity? You see what I'm getting at?
I understand.
Are you Thomas in Villainy, who also teaches and works in TV?
No, I understand.
Or are you, you know?
It genuinely varies depending on the situation. Because the thing is that it's, like, say, for example, playing in Villainy, I forget about that a lot of the time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, because most of the time, and I forget that we have fans, which is kind of weird, but, like, literally, playing in Villainy is me and my friends Neil, Dave, and James all in a room together.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's what it's like 98% of the time. And then we go out on tour, and we have, you know, rad people who come up to us and say, you know, you've changed, like, literally, we've had people come up and saying, you know, you changed my life.
Wow, or, that's,
you
know, great, man.
You kept me alive, or you provided light at this dark moment, or it was wonderful. And that, it still blows my mind, because, you know, I'm still very, very connected to that notion of that switch over where you go from playing to your friends to, like, just playing to entire groups of strangers.
Yeah, and that
switch over is kind of is fascinating. But, like, yeah, in terms of how I actually frame things, when I'm on tour, I'm absolutely Tom from Villainy. And when I, but in terms of, like, how I, say, for example, when I met my now wife, I didn't actually tell her I played in a band for, like, until, like, the second date.
Did she not like rock music?
No, she loved rock music. We were at Slipknot last night. That was fucking great.
Oh, that would have been amazing.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, I basically went back and channeled all kinds of 16-year-old angst at that point in time. But, yeah.
I could have gone to Method, well, like, anyone could have gone to Method Man and Red Man on Tuesday. I could have gone, like, I was offered a ticket, but I could have paid and gone. And I'm like, the thing with hip-hop shows is when they're amazing, but there's a lot of really cruddy live hip-hop, even from some of the biggest artists. But just related to you saying, obviously, Slipknot were amazing last night. Apparently, Method Man and Red Man were on point back in the day, amazing the other night, so...
So you missed out.
I missed out.
But the thing is that you can never tell. Like, and that's the thing.
But I think it's more... I don't know, man. I'm not right. I mean, a lot of people say this, so I don't have to beat about the bush with it. Hip-hop's kind of studio music. And a lot of the time it doesn't translate on stage for a number of reasons. And then you add on top trying to get visas for a number of people and promoters that say they will make it and then they don't, you know, and blah, 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 blah. It can be a genre fraught with on-the-night disappointments.
Yeah, absolutely.
Down to, we don't really have a lot of budget, so we'll get the local in-house sound guy. And 9 times out of 10, he's like, this hip-hop shit is shit, and we'll set the levels at whatever. I wouldn't have been like at that show. But, yeah, there are all these things. But anyway, they're apparently amazing. Where were we? We were going Method Man, Red Man at Slipknot. Didn't tell your wife that you...
Played in the band.
Played in the band.
So in terms of the identity, it kind of varies. And the thing that, you know... I'm proud of what we do in Villainy, but the thing I get, you know, most kind of like, you know, when I talk to my mum about, I mostly talk to my mum about teaching. She's a teacher as well.
Yeah.
And so, like, that's what we kind of, you know, we both talk about, you know, that process of, like, how best to kind of, like, stick information in people's heads.
But it must be nice for her because, I mean, I don't know, like, I think any parent, no matter how kind of liberal they are or how kind of down with arts and creativity and stuff and whatever, to me it's like, you know, her son's not only in a huge band, but you kind of have something else there as well, you know? It's kind of like...
No, totally.
I think a lot of people are kind of perhaps... not held back, but, you know, make different decisions or whatever based on, you know, kind of family going, oh, you should, how long are you going to do that thing? It's not going to last. It might only be 2 years, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. My parents have always been incredibly supportive of me, and I've got two brothers as well who they've both been, you know, incredibly supportive of. But it's kind of also one of the things that I'm genuinely lucky to have been born into that family, to those parents, you know what I mean? Like, there are so many weird things that, like, that have kind of made me the way that I am, that is basically down to the fact that my parents chose to get together.
Are they still together?
Yeah. Yep.
After. Yeah. Well, so, yeah, we look at each other like, oh, that's an achievement. You know, it's like,
no, but like it these absolutely. Days, like, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like, yeah. It absolutely is. And, like, it's so interesting having that as a backdrop, because yeah. You've like, the thing that I've always been...
And they're still together, still, like, hanging out?
Yeah, totally.
Awesome.
Yeah. Like, they... It's kind of wonderful because they... I don't know. It's like you've always got a safety net. And I basically feel way more comfortable taking risks in terms of, like... Well, pretty much anything. Because I know, like, it's that kind of that, you know, that middle-class white kid of being able to go home and live with my parents if I, you know, decide to go to New York and it doesn't work out. Because sometimes going to New York...
Yeah, I like the way you frame that, man. It's like, yeah, to think of it as like a luxury to have essentially a functional family with a house.
No, shit, yeah. but it is.
No, totally. Yeah. And we even forget about just even for the city we live in and the country we live in and what, you know, but I get that. I didn't know if I was going to touch on this, but I will, because you know how they say at dinner parties you shouldn't talk about politics or religion, but, you know, two of the most grounded and enjoyable people I've found to be around at AET are yourself and Thomas number two, and there's a background there in the Quakers, is that right?
Which I don't know
a lot about. And when I first heard this with Thomas number two, it kind of surprised me when I first met him, because I didn't know enough about the Quakers, and I thought it was maybe more a take on religion that I was kind of used to. But so what is it essentially? And are you still a practicing, whatever that means, Quaker?
Because there's no
deity per se, is there?
Well, yeah, it's a difficult one because it really varies actually depending on where you are in the world.
Right.
In New Zealand, we've got a very kind of liberal,
yeah,
totally.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas in the US, you basically have Quakers, which are basically evangelical Christians who are probably right behind Trump. You know what I mean?
So, right. So you would have creationists overseas in the Quakers, whereas here...
I mean, and the thing is, there will be some people that will be creationist Quakers in New Zealand, but there'll also be Buddhist Quakers or atheist Quakers. Like, right. it's that...
See, there you are combining. We'll get to the bottom of this, because there you are kind of combining. Most people are like, you're with one religion. So to me, it's on the outskirts of religion if you can be a Buddhist and... You go, I'm a Buddhist Christian or I'm a Buddhist whatever.
Mm.
So how does it work?
So Quakerism basically comes down to, it basically was set up kind of in response to the Church of England in the 1600s, which was that anyone that wasn't part of the church, and in this situation the church was the authoritarian power, they were basically in charge of the message of, you know, quote-unquote God.
Yeah.
The founder of Quakerism, George Fox, when we were young, Quakers at Quakery camps as a teenager, we basically wrote parody erotic fiction based around George Cox.
Erotic fiction, for how old were you?
Kind of 16.
Okay, so erotic fiction when I was 16 probably would have taken the shape of something like Penthouse Forum. Where the hell did you know about erotic fiction from?
Because erotic fiction is a beautiful way of sharing your love of literature. And
so is this more like Mills and Boone than Penthouse Forum?
Yeah, yeah, give it a go. Anyway, sorry, just getting from Quakerism into penthouse. It's not graceful. But so basically...
No, that's right.
The Quakerism was set up in response to this kind of notion that a church is in charge of, you know, the attachment to the higher power.
Yeah.
And that's a kind of a metaphor which still definitely exists. So the notion that you can be a Quaker and not necessarily, you know, be in a physical, you know, church, and you can still kind of worship, that's great. You know, that's the thing. And so, like, and also, I guess the other thing is that the Bible isn't the literal word of God. Quakers kind of base their kind of things around, like, four testimonies to peace, integrity, equality, and simplicity. So, and they're kind of like, thing about Quakers is that Quakers are often very quiet, and
you mean in worship? Because I know that Thomas said it's kind of a meditative.
Yeah, the like a Quaker meeting for worship is real, real fucking weird to go into if you haven't been into one before. It's going into a circle of people all in silence until somebody just randomly, like, basically, you know, feels the spirit move them and they stand up.
Great. So to me, that's originally, to me, that's a real metaphor already for kind of trying to rally against or go against that kind of authoritarian church model, because you don't have someone up the front kind of...
That's the entire point. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Preaching the not only the word of God, but the word of the church and the doctrine and this, that, and the other. So already it's more of a kind of collaborative experience.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And, I mean...
Do you still go from time to time?
Very rarely.
Yeah.
And that's not to do with a, you know, a distaste for it. It's just down to purely pragmatic things.
Yeah.
The thing is that, like, it's... Just even just taking an hour out to kind of think about things is just a really sensible kind of approach. The thing that I've always really liked about
you, but by being a Quaker, you would do that. So rather than kind of meditating at home or whatever, I'm assuming you're tying that to going to the place of worship.
Which
which I think here's in Mount Eden. So it's open.
Yeah.
It's kind of open most of the day and stuff, and you can go in there.
Well,
and,
no. Like there's like a meeting for worship where there are people there.
Yeah.
And it's the that kind of that group worship, which is kind of the thing that is particularly appealing about it.
But it doesn't rely on everyone having a belief in God.
No, I mean, like...
So that is very different.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, my approach to most things like that is that I can speak Christian, like, as a language.
What does that mean?
It means you can kind of understand what people are talking about when they're kind of using really heavily, like... You know, Christian-themed language.
Oh, okay.
But like underneath that though is a core about how something should go. Like it's basically unpacking those metaphors, and that's something that I, you know, find kind of interesting. But in terms of like, definitely don't believe in a, but say androgynous, not the right word, anthropomorphic God.
Yeah.
I believe in people.
No Roman sandals.
No
business.
Yeah, no, I believe in people. I think people when they do things is rad, and one of the things that my
and the other thing is if you cut out all that hypocrisy tied up in a lot of those big long-standing religious organizations, is, you know, the actual, you know, what the Bible kind of tells you should do and not do with other people in the world is, you know, it's kind of good list of values to live by. It's just kind of got tied up in this weird kind of I was going to say political system, but I think, well, something like the Catholic Church, it's an economic system as well, right?
You know? Absolutely. I'm definitely not a hater of churches. I think everyone's got.
Hey, neither am I. I'm not going all black metal. We're not going to disappear and.
I think everyone's got to have bureaucracy, but I mean, I think fundamentally, dark.
Speaking of, I can save us there. Speaking of Norway, villainy, I looked today and you're aware of good old internet. You're aware of the Dutch black metal band? Well, they're just banded, aren't they?
No, I think they still play shows. They're just talking about the other villainy.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
They kind of church burners.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the name change as well, and I want to talk about the band in general, because I noticed, this is what I noticed, because you said it's just a bunch of buddies you grew up and played with, so you guys went to high school and stuff together?
We met on the internet.
Nice. On MSN chat?
On the bands.co.nz forum.
Oh, beautiful.
Mm.
Okay. So, it looked like to me, we'll get to the name change in a second, but you kind of formed in, well, you were Villainy in 2010, right?
Yeah, we've basically been Villainy for 6 years, and that kind of marks when Dave, our drummer, kind of came on board.
So how long had you been under the other name before that, a year or two?
Oh, God, I can't remember. It'd be something like that, yeah. Me and Neil have played, so Neil is the singer of Villainy. Me and Neil have played together since we were teens.
Okay, well, it still seems to me like you guys had a major label deal not too long after you were Villainy, right? It must have all happened really quickly. Like, wasn't that album, first album out?
We should probably clarify this. Like, the major label support that we've had is always, it's only ever been distribution.
I assume it's just distro, because there's not much else these days.
Yeah, well, the thing is that, like, we've paid for everything. Yeah. Like, that first album, basically, we paid for it out of our own pockets. You know what I mean? Like, that would have been, at that point in time, we could have bought it, like, put a deposit on a house together. Like,
wow.
But it's those kind of things. You basically, we haven't used the sales from album one to fund album two, because the thing is, we want to own what's kind of going on.
Totally. And you can now, like, I seeing you, you know, I was going to get to that later, like, just seeing you in the last 10 minutes, you know, after class is finished, just whacking a little bit more on that promotional video and then seeing it go up and it looks amazing and so on. So you kind of can own everything now. So with the in-house thing, that must have been, because here you are, you're this kind of relatively new band, you're talking about the fact there was a lot of money at stake, so there must have been a concerted decision really early on, to just do everything as fucking good as you can?
Totally.
Because if you're investing that sort of money, it must have been, you must have been really kind of believed in what you guys had.
Totally. So, I mean, but that's kind of been the ethos of how Villainy's kind of operated. The thing is that, like, in New Zealand, it's really easy to kind of, like, you basically have to kind of walk that line between taking yourself seriously and putting in the hard work, but not kind of going so serious that you can't make fun of yourselves. And I feel like we're kind of getting there, like, most of the way there. But, I mean, yeah, we're absolutely. Like, that's been the whole kind of thing with Villainy. It's why, like, that first album cover was made by Storm Thorgerson.
I was going to ask about that. So you got the Dark Side of the Moon.
You got the guy who did the Dark Side of the Moon, who literally made this one other album cover, and then he died. Like, literally, our album cover is the second to last one that he did.
And his list of album covers is nuts. And it's varied artwork, too.
Yeah, it's
like from Megadeth to Pink Floyd. Yeah, really crazy
Led
different.
Like Houses of the Holy.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
And what was that? Just like you find the dude's email, good old modern day. Because I thought there must have been a connection through meeting recording studio guys and this, that, and the other to that. But was that just you guys?
No. The story is literally, we sent him an email.
Yeah.
Said, hey, we like your work,
yeah.
You know, as you do, and he's like, "All right, yeah, I like your things." Well, you know,
that's what I was asking about, because I think I would hope that he wasn't one of those pay for play guys. So he actually wanted to hear the music,
totally,
and see if he was feeling it before he.
The thing that was really great about, and one of the things I really cherish, is we've got all of these emails from him of being like, basically his creative process. Like, you basically send him all the lyrics, and he basically sends you a six or seven kind of mock-ups. Yeah. I think it was eight, actually. And you kind of, like, basically pick your favorite one and you kind of, go with that and tweak it up from there.
And was it like, yes, when you got it? Or was it like, oh, that's a bit weird? it's no Dark Side of the Moon.
But, no, we looked at it and kind of went, oh, yeah, that's good. I mean, we had
often the ones that grow on you are the better ones.
The album cover that we've got has like a whole bunch of people kind of walking in and out of like walls on the floor, and they're kind of stuck in there, and they're all basically naked dudes, effectively. Like, but it's kind of, they're not real human people. Like, that's kind of the idea.
Yeah.
It's a metaphor for everything.
It's a metaphor for everything.
It's a metaphor.
Bro.
It's like that classic kind of 3 AM thing. We all bleed the same. We're all the same height in the dark.
Captured best in the film Human Traffic, I think.
Mm.
Yeah.
But with that, when he shot it, we literally had to go through and were like, all right, this is slightly too real, because like one of the guys had like, you know, like a tribal tattoo on his arm.
Right.
So basically had to remove that.
And why is that? It was too because, 90s Thailand?
Well, because like we didn't want them to be like, we wanted them to be human.
You wanted them to be like human, cyborgy human-y.
Totally, yeah. Rather than, and like one guy had a hairy ass. And so we're like, all right, we're going to have to Photoshop his hairy
ass. So how does this guy work? Because you've got these very different styles of album cover. And so hairy asses is not very Dark Side of the Moon design-wise. So does he work, by that stage, was he working in Photoshop and kind of manipulating?
Yeah, well, he's got studios attached with him. So it's him and, you know, other guys kind of working together. And so from what I understand, I don't know the actual, like, the workflow. But it's his ideas that he basically works with other people to help realize.
Yeah. And so, did you ever actually, modern communication, ever actually chat to him, or was it all just electronic?
No, it was all electronic. We've just got a whole lot of an email trove of Stormforges and emails.
And then, you know, I know this is not why people are in it, so it goes without saying, but it's always nice to kind of, you know, recoup investments and so on. A lot of money was put on the table. You mentioned that. The album, I think, went to number one in the New Zealand album charts and something like number four in the album charts here. Does that translate in these modern times we live in with kind of money coming back in, or?
To a certain extent. Like, I mean, the thing is that making money in music has always been hard. It's harder now than it has been previously. It's a matter of kind of...
Though perhaps easier when your slice of the pie isn't 8% after everything else.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you basically have to take more ownership for your things. And so as a result, the bands that are able to make money, or like, I shouldn't say make money, because you don't really make money, but the ones that are able to actually sustain themselves.
Cover them, keep going.
Are bands that basically have worked out how to kind of work those things. And I remember like reading, there was the article in the Herald, would have been last year. I can't remember the band it was. I think it was Shed, who had their album, which was really great. But the album, the article was about how they, you know, had sold, I think, 20 or 30 copies of the CD and 80 copies of iTunes.
Yeah, I do remember that. And it kind of went viral online, at least amongst music
people. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Because it's a really interesting one, because I totally agree that we make very little money out of Spotify. Like, we just don't. We've crossed over into, like, you know, hundreds of, you know, thousands of listens across, you know, all the tracks, and it's still small.
What really, really bugs me about that streaming model, and it's about a bigger picture than, you know, it's about a whole kind of power, I guess, reclaiming power, losing power, you know, so the idea that the internet was really democratic, and it has been in a lot of ways, and it kind of opens up, you know, you to be able to quickly whip it together a video and put it up and this and the other thing. To me, like, all those streaming services are like the music industry having figured out again how to take back. I have a friend who was releasing dance tunes on little labels around the world in the 90s, and they did okay for what they were and so on and stuff. He amazed me a couple months ago telling me that he's got stuff up on Spotify or one of the other big ones that he actually can't take down based on historical contracts that didn't even take into consideration this whole phenomena.
Totally.
So basically he is seeing no return on a whole bunch of his music being out there from then, when he was really prolific, a whole lot of hard work and stuff. And, you know, not so much I, you know, he's family man, three kids and stuff now, not so much I need to, you know, preserve my career, but it's more like an ethical consideration.
Totally,
you know?
Yeah.
And so that's what really annoys me, as I say, is like, you know, it's like Facebook, and I'm on there all the time and stuff, but it's like corporations figuring out how to fucking turn the internet back into what was before the internet. You know, I think there's a real struggle between the great things it's done and then that kind of power play. I don't know.
Totally. No, I absolutely. Like, yeah. I think that's
my little.
It's your soapbox. It's great. You can do what you want to do.
Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that I basically have to remind myself about when we kind of like deal with these things is that what you have to do is also remember at the same time is the thing that happens off the back of that, of this kind of really, you know, quite manipulative system,
yeah,
is that if you write the song that resonates with the people at that one point in time, you go around the world.
Totally.
Like that.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's good.
And that's the thing that you basically, it kind of comes down to content.
So when are you guys going to go around the world? I mean, you know, physically, not binary. Must be on the. You sound like a band with, you know, plans. You're a great band. You're huge here. You must be thinking about trying to take territories.
I mean, we're working at Australia, and it's kind of a question of working out which eggs you put in which baskets. Because the thing is that, contrary to popular belief, we're not as wealthy as you may think. And like
first
to,
album.
Mm, but the thing is to get into you know, into Australia or. Well, sure, not Australia, but like, you know, the UK or the US, where you have to, you know, pay to get onto festivals and those kind of things.
Yeah, you have to pay to get onto festivals.
Yeah,
so it's like like doing the public version of a trade show.
Effectively, yeah. Like, I mean, that's, you know, that's how like a lot of things kind of end up working. Totally.
Wow. So wow. Okay. So,
but I mean, that's why you know there will be bands that will tour. You know, basically do like a big. You know, a big New Zealand tour, and then use the money from that to like fund the next overseas kind of excursion.
So you know how I mean? How was it witnessing the AC/DC machine? Was it a machine? Did you get to witness the machine?
Yeah, totally. Like I was in awe the entire time of just that entire setup. Cause I mean, the thing is that like I'm one of those guys that probably, still has that kind of stonerish part of my brain still very well intact, which kind of goes, oh my god, someone made this. but it's literally, that's what's happening around the back of the stage, where you're like looking up at all of the LED, you know, monitors that are there, all of these individual things, and there are like, you know, 3,000 of them, and somebody has hand wired all of those together to make that big fuck off screen.
Yeah, right.
And so I was basically watching that and it's kind of going, oh my god.
Do you know the Rolling Stones have got two, right? Have you heard that?
No, just in case one breaks down.
No, not just in case one breaks down. They're such a well-oiled machine and such a touring behemoth, I guess, that the next one is being set up in the next space it needs to be. So I'm not sure how it works city to city, but I think certainly country to country, yeah, they have two whole complete rigs. So that's two whole sets of road crew, two whole sets of aircraft, two whole, it's amazing.
Totally.
There's an amazing, and it was on TV3 of all places. I was like, this is a really kind of quite odd thing for TV3 to be playing on a Sunday night or whenever it was. Mm. But AC/DC live in Argentina, but it's shot with, you know, the most high definition cameras ever. It's stunning, but it gives you a real sense because it comes in from every angle of just how fucking crazily huge those shows are. Yeah. So when you're on stage with those, I was thinking like, do they monitor you, like, so you it feels as big for you as that system? Or, like, do you get the sort of same impact being on that stage?
Yeah, to a certain extent. Like, I mean, we didn't have the catwalk, which, you know...
I mean just purely sonically. Like, do you get that same...
Yeah, yeah, totally. Right. Well, I mean, the thing is, that we, like, for those shows, we played for the first time with in-ear monitors.
Yeah.
So basically, rather than having like a, you know, your traditional fold back in front of you, which is where you get your stage sound from, basically everything was in your ears, because on a stage that size,
just like earbuds.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, like fancy earbuds.
But don't you want that feel of the?
You do. You absolutely get that.
Yeah. Like, oh, you do from the back of the speakers. Yeah,
yeah, totally. And so, but it's like you take one step. If you didn't have them, you take one step away from your fold back. Yeah. And then all of a sudden you lose the drums, you lose everything. It's literally you just kind of like in space and everything becomes really far away.
Right.
And coupled that, when you're playing like in a stadium, you like the slap back of like a snare basically goes, kak, kak. So it becomes impossible to play in time if you don't have earbuds in.
So you move away from the four beat sound. And I was just thinking two things. So it must be really terrifying the first couple of times, because it's like it's just everything amped up to 20. I was gonna say with the earbuds, they must be they mustn't be just your standard, you know, I'll just buy the top end, you know, even $90 in-ear Sennheisers or whatever, because you miss your hearing.
Yeah, they must, so they must be we've got
a set now.
We got got molded ones from Pacific Ears. Thanks, Pacific Ears.
Thanks, Pacific Ears.
bloody hooking us up. It was really great. But I mean, the thing that I really enjoy about those, and the thing that one of the things I just enjoy in general is stagecraft in general. It's why I enjoyed Slipknot last night, and it's why I, you know, found it fascinating playing those shows.
Where did they play?
Victor.
Wow. Yeah. So it was all on.
Yeah. Scissor lifts and everything. It's great.
Oh, man.
But like playing AC/DC in that kind of environment is fascinating because you are. The main difference, and this is something I hadn't thought about, is the height difference. Like, normally, when we're playing, say, like, you know, at very, very most, we're kind of like, you know, people are kind of like around maybe shins in terms of how high they are.
Do you mean people in general? Like, is this going to be a story about how short Angus Young is?
No, not at all. No. Nothing about that at all. Oh, it's okay. Literally just down to the fact that when you're playing on a stage that size, the viewing angle.
Your elevation.
Our elevation is so high compared to them. Yeah. That you have these really kind of, it's that weird notion of people aren't people anymore. They're a sea. They are a crowd. Because, like, they were massive crowds.
That stadium in Argentina, that's one of the things that struck me. It's so huge. I was like, I kind of got out because I thought about those bands, those Metallicas, those AC/DCs, those Stones, and you go, because I was on Howard Stern or something, I watched Metallica play Master of Puppets, and I was like, how can you vibe off playing that for the probably 150,000th time? But then when you see those stadiums, it's like, that just must, as a human being and what that does to your senses, it mustn't matter that you're playing the same thing over and over and over every night. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Like, the thing is that...
Because that stadium in Argentina is like, I think it was 100,000 people or something. It was nuts.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Like, it's magic. Like, the catharsis that you get from...
And I think it's just to survive that as a human. You can see why so many people just...
Yeah, I mean, the whole setup is outrageous. And the thing I found really interesting is that between the first and the second show, I actually had to get a longer lead because I couldn't get to the corner of the stage.
Right.
So I literally had to go down to the rock shop on the day of the Auckland show
and be like, "Next thing to go wireless."
Hey, yeah, 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 yes, probably.
Yeah.
And then basically play like Dillinger Escape Plan and like kind of be upside down a lot of the time. That's the end goal. I need to get good at balancing though. I'm not good at balancing. But the thing that I found fascinating was working out how you actually play that kind of show. And so in between the first and the second show, like I kind of realized that you basically have to move way faster because you've got much more ground to cover. So in terms of your kind of station on that side
right,
of the stage.
Right, so for you, I get it. So for you to pull off the same little groove, you know, between whatever bit of tune, you got to run twice as hard.
Totally.
You watch Angus, especially for, you know, getting to be an elder gent.
Mm-hmm.
He runs in those shows, man.
He's fit. Yeah, totally.
He's kind of built for... He's a little, really little wiry guy, you know.
He's a nugget.
He's a nuggety unit. Yeah.
But I mean, it's the funny thing that no one tells you before you're playing a headline tour is that you need to get fit beforehand. Because otherwise, two-thirds of the way through, you start kind of going, oh my God, how do I look like I'm having a good time? But my body inside is just dying. Like, you literally have to kind of like make those deals with yourself.
So when's the next big... So who is in-house, out-house, upside, downside? So everything's in-house, but you had Universal and then Warner's doing distro deal. Surely you got to farm out... I heard Mr. Larkin talk about this, how when he was managing Sheehardy looks back on it and, you know, it's a role he said that kind of doesn't often combine with being creative and being in the band and so on. So is there actually someone managing you guys or?
Yeah, Larkin's managing us.
Oh, is he?
Yeah.
Okay, and that was the other thing I wanted to ask before we move on to something else is, so that connection as well, getting into that studio, was that like contacting Storm in that you just went, this is the guy to do it?
No, that was, we worked with Mark Kneebone, from...
Promoter kind of, guy.
From everything.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he told us was that basically you guys either need to knuckle down and make an album, or you guys need to break up. That was basically what he said many moons ago.
Because you end up going around in circles?
Or you end up getting kind of really stagnant, you know what I mean? And so
doing that King's Arms gig twice a year and yeah.
And so this was, you know, this was before Villainy became Villainy. And Tom happened to be in the country and was looking at, you know, more producing projects. He had basically been kind of getting into that. Because he'd already made like Geographica by Weta, and you know, worked with Fur Patrol and those kind of bands.
Many years before, though.
Totally, yeah. And so we basically kind of sat down and we're kind of on the same page, and it's really, really important with, especially for us at that point in time, because Tom, the thing that Larkin does, which is different to a lot of other producers, is that he is very particular about the songwriting kind of aspect. And so for us, when we first came to do that first album, we were very green, and so didn't actually understand what actually made a hook a hook. Right. What made a, you know, this particular riff
better than this riff. So he's really, really, aside from the recording process, helped you as artists.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, like, he, on that first record especially, he basically, you know, was like, it was a punishing kind of exercise, both in terms of, like, songwriting, but in terms of playing as well. Like, I think a lot.
So does he engineer as well, or produce with an engineer from his from his company?
So so Samuel Kay is his kind of main in-house recorder, engineer slash producer, who also mixed our second album, Dead Sight.
Yeah,
and he is, as well as being a lovely human, and also someone that I had never actually met before, but had spent a lot of time. We'd basically been on the same internet forums as teenagers, like into the same band.
So he's a Kiwi guy living in Melbourne.
Totally, they both are. And so we basically had this. But Sam's also got a really kind of like niche love of like intense pop hooks and like really intense like kind of like asynchronous kind of riff work.
Yeah.
And so we basically approach things the same way. Like, especially me and him, we get on really well because we're both basically massive riff nerds. Because
so like, it sounds like they crafted you into still a tough sounding band, but with better songs and more appeal.
I mean, the thing is that like it was crafting things that were already there. Like
I don't doubt that at all.
You know, it was a relationship where we kind of worked together, and it was more like kind of, you know, being asked, can you need to rewrite this bit to make it better.
What you're also saying is that you found a sweet dude, you know, you meet Tom and it happens that you really get on, he's got faith in you, and then it turns out that you go back with the engineer online, and so you actually end up somewhere quite kind of intimate and comfortable.
Totally. I mean, the thing that I like about like working with those guys is that they kind of get what you're trying to go for, and they get kind of the nuance when it comes to like to riff work. You know what I mean? Mm. And it seems like a weird kind of thing to kind of point out as, but it's like it's the stock of like a rock band.
Yeah.
Like, it's what you need as you know, if we're going to keep going with this kind of you know, cooking metaphor, that's your base.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, and
that's your source.
Totally. Yeah. And that's like the most important thing. And it's the thing that like I basically nerd out on them probably the most out of anything, is because it's like, it's like the ultimate combination of
the sauce can only just be garlic and tomato and one or two herbs.
Mm, absolutely, but like it's the ultimate combination of art and science. You know what I mean? Like it's like sciencey maths, where you're basically getting the numbers and you're putting the numbers in the right order to make the sweetest possible riff. So those are your ingredients. So you've only got like this many notes, got this many kind of like, you know, beats per bar. And you basically kind of work out how you can kind of make the most exciting thing happen inside of that.
Have you seen, you must have seen the Beautiful Machine doco.
Mm.
Man, because I was thinking, you know, if anyone's going to have advice based on that career and that story, I don't know, I thought about it after I watched it, and obviously, as I say, it's a time, you know, those guys were around growing up, you know, Wellington's a small place.
Mm.
They were also the band. They were also, you know, extraordinarily, as I say, professional show-wise from the beginning. I've never actually seen or spotted them kind of make an error. And if they have, you know, it hasn't been noticed. They're like the kind of... so to watch that, and I'd heard kind of bits of the kind of early 2000s unraveling and stuff. And to watch that all, it was so like kind of heartbreaking and amazing at the same time. Have you seen? Because I was thinking about it afterwards. I was like, that has to be the best New Zealand music doco I've ever seen. And then I thought, what are other New Zealand music docos?
Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely scope for it, because New Zealand's relationship with music is kind of fascinating. Like,
it is.
We're a weird isolated island, and there's particular things that kind of come through.
I think, you know, some people moan here and there, blah, 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 blah. But I think the decision to really tie the family into it was really cool. I think the decision to get really honest about kind of the mental health aspects of what they were doing was really cool.
I'll never forget,
humor-wise, I nearly fell off my seat in the theatre. I think it's Carl and Tom talking about John left on stage for the first time ever, telling the joke, I won't ruin it, but then the description of, I think Carl had a towel over his head and Tom lifted one side of it and they just stood there with a towel over their head so they couldn't see anything.
Yeah.
And then they all flew back to New Zealand or Australia.
Yeah.
While they're under that towel, that's 15, 20 years or whatever of...
Totally. I mean, that's the thing, though, is that it's really tenuous. Like, it is.
So what's up? You're a positive dude, man. What's up with the quite dystopian song titles? No Future? And is it... What's with the footage of them? Because you're now you're vegetarian?
Yeah, I don't eat the animals.
I listened to something earlier on where you were talking about taking a crock pot on tour and having ribs. Has that changed recently?
Yeah, I mean, like, we'll give most things a go. Like,
no, because I saw the meat footage in the video and it wasn't like the Skeptics AFCO. It wasn't like, But I don't know the lyrics, but I wondered whether it was some kind of vegan propaganda.
No. No, you have to remember that I'm not the lead singer of the band. Those aren't my
lyrics. You don't write the lyrics, yeah.
I mean, like, I think a lot of the... I don't know why the song titles are dystopian. I think that if you had, like, happy fun time songs, it just wouldn't kind of really resonate with a rock audience.
Okay. Well, I say, at least we got past that kind of Dungeons and Dragons-esque 80s...
What's wrong with that?
...rock metal lyric thing.
It's
always what I couldn't sort of...
I love it so much. Like, the thing is, I mean...
I think 80s Dungeons and Dragons metal lyrics are why I still haven't watched an episode of Game of Thrones. It's just all tied in together.
Right, you've got some baggage.
I have a cross-genre, cross-art prejudice against fantasy, and I don't know what it is. Yeah. I like the Dungeons and Dragons guys when I was at uni and stuff. It's not that.
I mean, the thing is that, like, it kind of depends on the context. Like... I really like my 80s hair metal with, you know, the most ridiculous lyrics about, you know, like...
Yeah, but like Sunset Strip, titty, silly lyrics, or Morgoth, the king of the blue, like...
Yeah, I'm keen on all of that. Like, don't get me started on my love for the Incredible String Band. The Incredible String Band and their song, the Minotaur song,
right.
So good. Like, it's... I assume you probably were not going to edit this at all and kind of cut in the Incredible String Band.
I could probably do that. Look, it's...
You
it's
should.
Brain material.
Play it now. Play it now.
I live in a labyrinth under the sea.
I can actually do that, but I'll do it later. I was thinking if a guest had some sort of existential crisis after they left, I'd probably edit something out. I'm not holding people to ransom. I might edit... I don't know, it feels like the engineering side of it is, I really want to do these just long-form podcasts, but I feel like there should be some kind of production from me. So with that...
I like the dark as can be.
He likes the dark as can be.
I said everything's on the tables here for a reason. I haven't named that bag, but I think the... ex-radio host in me needed a feature on the podcast. So that is currently the easy segue bag. So if you'd like to take a piece of paper out of that.
Great. Are there things in here?
You need to read them out.
So here's something from the easy segue bag. What is freaking you out right now? Not well right now, but day to day lately. That's an interesting one.
Yeah, well, I started writing some and they got a little too... I don't want that bag to be full of, like, you know, can you kind of break down your thoughts on the US election or, you know, blah, 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 blah. But that probably is one of the more... That's probably one of the deeper questions in the bag, Thomas.
So what is freaking me out right now? I'm freaked out about I'm a little bit freaked out about the US elections, but I'm more freaked out about... They're kind of more... I'm freaked out about what's going to happen to the media over the next couple of years. I think there's some really interesting.
Is that related to the election somehow? Or are
I'm thinking about other things I'm freaked out about.
You mean the death of? Well, I shouldn't say the death because there's still a lot of good stuff around. You mean the change from a lot of people reading investigative journalism to clickbait, that sort of thing?
Or? Yeah, I think there's some really interesting things that are kind of happening, around the edges. But the reality is that, like, when it comes to quote unquote mainstream New Zealand, people are still watching exactly the same kind of television shows that have always been being watched. And I find that a really kind of interesting kind.
How long can it last?
And that's kind of, that's a really kind of,
because I notice now, even like, so students coming through certificate, which is prior to degree, over the years, a number of them have had, they're young, but a lot of them have had quite kind of traditional media diets, because I'm teaching TV and radio for that, I want to know what they're kind of into. But even that cohort now are watching much more interesting shows on Netflix and this, that, and the other. So what I'm getting at is, I think in the younger generation, regardless of, you said middle New Zealand or whatever, I think there's going to be a shift. That's even true. With that lot. So surely, I mean, I know you're worried about it, but how long can that model last? I probably in the last, because I've actually become so hopelessly addicted to listening podcasts that I actually need to pull it back a little. So there's that, and then watching all the stuff that people recommend you online. But because of work and stuff, I was still keeping an eye on broadcast television. I'm at a point now where I might put it on for 10 minutes at night while I lie in bed to fall asleep, like the radio. Like it's gone for me in the last year. And you described the same thing when you came in here. So yeah, you're worried, but yeah. Do you think it's going to be a model that's going to be around in 20 years?
Yeah, well, I mean,
that's such a hard question.
No, totally. I'm definitely not looking into that particular.
Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting because the role of traditional media is still incredibly, incredibly powerful. But what you've got are journalists that have fewer and fewer resources at their disposal, and so it's basically the ability to have people that have time to actually go through all of the press releases and the weird shit that gets put out, weird, like, 80-page documents from, like, the Ministry of Justice. Like, it's that kind of thing that I'm worried about.
Yeah, and stuff to the, like, I think of, like, stuff in the Herald and so on, they often get derided for just that. But I noticed that, and I forget her name, good old being put on the spot chatting, but very good investigative journalists, I forget her name. That doesn't matter. But anyway, there's a team of three or four.
Was it
of
Nikki
them.
Hager?
No. Younger woman. Anyway,
and Nikki Hager's a man.
I know. Said it wasn't Nikki Hager. Anyway, so stuff in the Herald and so on do, if you dig a little deeper, still do have investigative journalism. But don't worry, I'm right with you. I'm right with you there. But I noticed even I went to find it when I heard about it. I'm like, oh, so stuff's got. I went to this talk at Golden Dawn about the future of journalism, funnily enough, and they spoke about it. I was like, wow, I never knew. So they're putting up video content, doing kind of long form proper journalism. I couldn't actually find it on the main page of Stuff, so that's their kind of market mentality. So it's like, sure, they're doing it, but you're going to find 18 cat stories before you actually find that stuff there.
Totally.
So do you think that's going to end up with what middle New Zealand's just going to become more and more increasingly uninformed?
I'm worried about in terms of things that are freaking me out.
Your question.
That's okay. You're allowed to have your feelings too. Yeah. I mean, it's just basically a lack of kind of empathy for what's kind of going on, and I think it's easy to kind of like push quite important issues underneath the carpet, not pay attention to things.
A lack of empathy is your lack of empathy is related to a lack of quality information.
I believe so.
So if you're being fed, someone the other day said, and I posted up on Facebook like it was my own quote. I didn't even put quote marks around it. I just put it like it was me. And like, we live on a diet of shit food and shit information, and there's something really in that for a lot of people,
That's true. Actually, I should have said, the thing that actually really freaks me out is what happens when plant-based milk becomes totally normal. Like, as in, like, the milk kind of grown in test tubes, not involving cows at all. What happens to the New Zealand economy?
How much is that around?
It exists currently. And the thing
they
is,
can
is
make
that,
a steak in a lab now, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah. but what kind of happened off the back of that is that you kind of go, oh, well, you know, I mean, I assume you kind of go, man, I'm not really interested in, like, you know, eating, having fake milk. But the thing is, it's not for you. It's for, like, any large-scale manufacturer. They're going to go for, like, the fake milk that is more milky, more cheap to produce, more, you know, basically 100% more milky than anything we could ever get out of a cow, which is weird.
Totally.
But that is effectively, that's coming in the next kind of, like, you know, couple of years.
Are you coming back to saying you worry about what will happen with the economy there? Mm-hmm. I think that, and I look at a company like Serato, who obviously have grown and grown and grown and grown and are like this great, what do you call them, small, medium enterprise tech company, you know, innovation mm-hmm. company in New mm-hmm. Zealand. I don't know whether, you know, who would it be, the Minister of, I'm trying to think who would it be, that would trade and development, business and development, whatever it's called. Anyway, I think
business
that...
I think
that related to that, we're sort of going off that topic to something I caught on to that you said, is that we're in the wrong focus, man. Dairy is like hugely polluting, takes up a huge amount of resources. We have this kind of brain drain, as they call it, but I just see it in terms of my friends who are highly qualified or creative or whatever, who now live overseas and have done long term. Mm-hmm. The powers that be, because I couldn't think of the name of the department, I think need to start focusing more on these small, innovative kind of New Zealand companies. This is moving totally away from milk. Mm. But to you saying that, like, our dairy industry might collapse, I don't know why we concentrate so much on...
There is genuinely a movement. Like, there's been, yeah. that's been a kind of seen as being a thing. And as a
but
result,
if there's no support from above...
But no, that's happening as well. Right, okay. Like, it's slowly happening. I only know this because my wife kind of works in that kind of area, and Stephen Joyce is very...
She's in the public service?
No, in the startup innovation tech kind of area.
Right.
But that's...
What's she making?
She is works for Biz Dojo, who make effectively, what's the right word? Workplace communities. Like, they basically, they curate like places for startups to actually grow.
Yep.
Which is a really hard thing to explain to your grand.
Yeah, it's like mentoring with feng shui. It's like
it's about, like, you know, making a space where people actually want to collaborate and hang out together.
Oh, that's good too. You kind of updated me on that, because that little riff came from was that it had already kind of bothered me, because it was related to, as I say, just how many of my friends kind of live in New York and Melbourne and London and whatever, and whether, you know, sort of relates to focus here and stuff. But where it really solidified for me, and it's still a video I reckon really worth watching everyone, is, I think his name's Sir Paul Callaghan. He's a kind of regarded New Zealand thinker who's passed away now, but there's a great YouTube video, probably one of the top hits if you Google his name, about his very, very well reasoned argument, complete with, you know, relevant statistics and so on, about how New Zealand's economy's kind of got the wrong focus. And I think that's probably from about 2010, so that is kind of older. How long have you got with me? We're actually over an hour.
Let's go another 10 minutes and see what we can do.
Okay. We could take another question from the...
Do you want me to look into the...
I don't know. Like, I think we can do this on our own, but then I did write some quite... The idea with the questions is...
Your awkward satchel of
I have no... That's what I'm going to call it. So I have, absolute 100% faith in my ability to keep these going. I didn't put the bag there for that. but it was, as I say, the radio feature. But also, I thought, wouldn't it be nice, because, you know, people post up, oh, so-and-so from blah, blah, blah is coming in. Have you got any questions for him? Well, I don't want... or her. My audience to kind of know who's coming in too soon beforehand. So I thought what the audience could do is, I don't need to write these anymore, but we build up a bag of fairly haphazard and random questions about all sorts of things. So I think with that, perhaps to give what will be hopefully an audience the idea, you should grab another one from the, what did you call it? The
awkward satchel of segues.
The awkward satchel of shame.
What kind of bird is Big Bird?
Well, that's a little better than... I mean, it's a little less heavyweight
See, this
than...
is just you and your weird Muppet fixation. What's going on there?
Well, I put that one in there for people I know, and you obviously know me, but it is something that has... Because it's... She's kind of canary-like, but...
I hadn't tried to place her in the real world. Like, for me, Big Bird is Big Bird. You know what I mean? Like, sorry for the incredibly, like, opaque stonerish answer. But no, but she is.
Sesame Street's pretty real, man. You know, that's New York. That's the street. And
that's exactly what it's
bird.
Like, yeah. Yeah, I don't...
I mean, obviously I know Oscar is pushing the bounds of real New York, but I think Big Bird is...
So I thought you were about to tell me what kind of animal Oscar actually was.
It's Grouch. Right. So Big Bird,
yeah.
I think has to be some... Was Big Bird just Big Bird?
I reckon Big Bird's the love child of a canary and an emu. That was an awkward copulation.
Or just, I wish moas were still around, because maybe a moa, but yeah, did you say an emu or an ostrich, an emu?
Yeah. Well, got a half sea would be pretty good.
Emu and a canary, that's, I mean, you don't want to think about how that happened, I guess.
No, it's true. It's brutal. I'm going to get another one before we get too dark into bird coitus.
I was going to think, we thought we could end it there, it would be quite a nice place, but there you go. Oh, three in, I'm not sure I'm going to have three in episode, but we'll...
There you go.
We'll go with this.
If you could tell your 13-year-old self something now, what would it be?
Now, I stole that. I stole that from a media production workshop student's documentary topic. So,
that's
great. Shani, if you're listening, shout out. It's a great topic.
I would tell my 13-year-old self that everything is going to be okay, and fundamentally that if you put in... the hard work, the most important things are your ideas, and to not get stuck on one idea, it's to do as many as possible. And one of the things we haven't talked about is my work at the Download. We're basically working with, you know, three quite...
Thank you. I really did want to cover that, because it's the thing about you I know the least about. So
right. So basically, the Download concept is run by three guys, Nigel, Jared, and Ryan, who are all kind of director writers. And the way that they collaborate together basically is just about, it's about the quantity of ideas,
yeah.
And inside of that you distill the quality. And it's that notion, that approach to creativity is exactly
okay, so the quantity of ideas you still, okay, yep.
Because you basically get the kernel of the idea and then you kind of refine it from there. But if you're kind of like self-censoring as you're kind of like coming up with ideas, you very rarely get anything that's actually interesting or workable or, you know...
Well, that's why I like the idea of...
Or you get really attached to one particular thing and no one's allowed to touch it because you've spent too long working on it.
That's why I like the idea of this, because to me it kind of relates to the limitations of a lot of broadcast media where you go blah, 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 and then someone yells at you about buying sausages for 5 seconds, and then you come on and you do this little soundbite, and that kind of freeing thing of just let it come out.
Can we do the sausage ad now? What's your favourite sausage company? We'll give them a shout out.
Well, I once had to eat those really
Pam's.
Cheap Mad Butcher ones, and right. they actually had pieces of bone in them. Huh. And by the way, are you living vicariously through me as a reformed meat eater, asking me about...
I've eaten meat. I understand.
I
what
saw
it's
Sausage
like.
Party last night.
Gross. Oh, the movie.
Yeah.
Sorry, I thought you were talking about the adult film.
It is an adult film.
Mm.
I wouldn't take kids to see it. Mm. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
Oh, man. It was really polarized people, you know, looking around at places where public and reviewers and stuff can comment. And I kind of saw both sides of it. I nearly turned it off. Then I kept going. I'd say see it, but I had sort of much higher hopes for the concept, and the trailers seemed so funny and so on. I haven't got to the famous food sex scene at the end, but...
Huh.
I've got about 20 minutes to go. So that gives you... I probably wasn't kind of like glued to my seat if I've got 20 minutes to go, but I will finish it, whereas some things I won't. So before we go back to the Download concept, the other thing was I thought John Bridges was a part of part of that, no?
So John Bridges works on 7 days. Right. So 7 days was...
That's your... mate. That's the... What's the term? That's their jewel in the crown. 7 days is their...
Yeah. So 7 days was a download concept idea which was taken to TV3. And so they basically control the production of it. And we basically work as producers. So this evening I will be going and watching the live show. Which is 2.5 hours long, so it's a Thursday.
Yeah, and they separate the wheat from the chaff. And
basically,
half an hour. Wow.
So me and John will basically both have laptops writing down all of the jokes that get covered over the course of the show. And we're basically doing the first...
Oh, you're producing it. That's amazing.
Oh, yeah. Well, normally what I do is I'm one of three people, but the other guys from the download are away in Australia, and so I'm stepping up.
Oh, that's what I was going to say. Oh, that's amazing. Oh, that congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
No, seriously, I'm not saying that like...
Oh, no, I understand. Yeah. No, it's a genuinely fun, interesting
job. You're producing
job.
One of the most, the highest rating and kind of talked about TV shows in New Zealand.
It's a really funny one.
That's also got longevity now.
It's a really interesting one.
That I will watch if I'm home.
Yeah, it's a really interesting one because it... For whatever reason, it has resonated with New Zealand audiences, I think specifically because it's not a vehicle for one person. Yeah. And that's fundamentally it. Like, is that most kind of ideas tend to come down to like having, you know, say two comedians on there for most of the content.
Yeah.
Whereas the way that 7 days works, and like, you know, in British panel shows, which is, it's, you know,
yeah, I'm a big,
which is based off, is basically off that notion, is that if you don't like one of the panelists, you'll probably like some of the other ones. And that's how it operates. Like,
totally.
And that's why, like, for me...
And I agree that British, like, never mind the Buzzcocks. I went through, I think it was when my master's was due, I was watching 4 or 5 of those in a row. Because they're great. Because, you know, you're like, switched on with that. And then you just watch, they're so great with the right guests and so on, you know.
Totally.
Yeah.
And it's about, and the thing I find interesting is because I've been working on that show for kind of like 5 or 6 years now.
Because I'm sure you told me around the middle before you were writing, or you were researching, what were you researching at the beginning for them? You were researching something.
What was I researching?
You told me right at the beginning. But anyway, I thought in the middle...
Oh, right at the beginning I was doing quiz questions.
Because in the middle you were kind of a fluffer, right?
Yeah, I've done a lot of fluffing.
Yeah. Because when I said that to you, you're like, no, I wasn't. And I was like, I'm sure you were. Because, you know, what we mean here is, you know, rocking the crowd up.
Oh, that? No. That's Jamie Bowen, mostly.
Oh.
I don't rock the crowd up.
Oh,
I'm not
okay.
A comedian. No, see, I get confused with Jamie Bowen a lot. It's kind of just having a...
What did he mean by fluffing?
Yeah, I understand. I tend to normally sit at the back of the room with a pen and a piece of paper, cool, writing notes about gags.
We'll wrap it up shortly. So every week you guys would... I looked into getting tickets for Fallon, I think, when I was going to go to New York. But so you will... Where do you get that studio audience from? You?
There is a waiting list of like... I think it's between 3,000 and 6,000 people.
Is it like a
people.
Night out? Can they have a drink while they're in stuff? Or is it just seats sitting forward?
Yeah, totally. Yeah,
so
no,
set up like a bar.
Yeah, you can have a drink. We're currently sponsored by Subway. Beautiful Subway and their lovely footlong. Oh, so much ranchy dressing. Oh, I love it. They don't give me anything.
No, I'm actually going to hope. I'm hoping if this goes anywhere that, you know, maybe I can slip a few of those in.
That sounds great.
Yeah, not necessarily Subways.
But you get food. Like there is free food and, you know, and drinks you can purchase and those kinds of things. So, yeah, you can totally have a night out. And the thing that I like about it is that it's, if you've only watched the show on TV3, you get a much different version of things. Because the thing is that, like we're talking before about self-censoring, the comedians don't tend to do that.
No,
like it's a really weird show.
I think it's a great show as an indication of where New Zealand's current censorship line is.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, you know how, like, you know, you can tell where a society's at based on the most out there thing on kind of broadcast television.
Totally.
Some of the things that get said that get left in, I'm like, whoa. I wonder if my grandmother's watching, you know?
Totally.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, my mum will watch you now and again and be like, that was quite a rude joke. I'm like, I'm sorry about that. But like, it's interesting. Like, we've definitely had conversations where there were basically two great gags involving the word, the cunt, basically.
Yeah.
And we basically like, well, we can't have both of them. We can choose one. Like, and so you basically end up doing kind of maths about like how offensive you can be and like how... what you need to have around that joke to make that joke not feel so intense.
But it also, it boils down to it, audiences kind of intelligence in a lot of ways. Like, to like with context, like, okay, so for example, people who think Louis C.K. is offensive, which is the thing I go down. But so to me, with the word cunt, it's like, it's not the word, it's four letters assembled to make that sound.
Yeah.
It's how you deliver it.
Absolutely.
So I could be more than assured that on 7 days, it's not going to be delivered in a hateful or derogatory way. This is why you can't blanket measurement words. It's old fashioned and it's odd and it's anal retentive.
Yeah.
You know?
So it's kind of like, it's the difference between me going, fuck, 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 when... Fuck you, Lewis.
Yeah.
You sack of shit.
Probably finished there.